Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to another classic replay with me, Justin Brierley. This is Unbelievable and we've been bringing you conversations that matter for over a decade and a half. Great one for you today. Richard Dawkins is well known for describing the Old Testament God as a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, among other things. Well, in this show from April 2011, Christian philosopher and apologist Paul Copen explained why he believes God's actions in the Old Testament are not immoral when taken in context, and he was opposite atheist speaker Norman Backrack. Don't forget, you can keep up to date with the latest from the show, get in touch, and find many more evergreen debates from the archive at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for joining me on the program today. And to give a little bit more background to both of you, Paul Copen, who's written the book Is God a Moral Monster today, is a Pledger Chair of Philosophy and Ethics at Palm Beach Atlantic University in Florida. Norman Backrack describes himself as an atheist humanist. He's also a member of the Ethical Society, which meets at Conway Hall. A warm welcome to you both, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining me on the program today.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you with me, Paul. Let's start with you. You're out in Florida, which is a lovely place to be a professor, I imagine. Do you get to sort of walk along the beach every morning and play in the sand?
The school is located right on the intracoastal waterway, which faces Palm Beach Island, just on the other side of which is the Atlantic Ocean, and it is lovely. Hurricanes aside, it's a great place to live.
Wow. Well, we're not jealous, you know. We're stuck here in London, though I have to say the weather hasn't been too bad here at our end, so I can't complain really. But it's a world away from Palm Beach, Florida. But that's where you do your work, and it's the work that you do that's really brought you into the remit of this program, Paul. Tell us a little bit of your background, Paul. Did you grow up in a sort of Christian environment? Did you have doubts yourself? How much has that played into what you do now?
Well, sure. I did grow up in a Christian home, but it really wasn't until high school that I started to wrestle with a number of intellectual issues. And the more I began to explore, the more I started to see how the Christian faith was not something that I could, you know, that I would should just believe because my parents taught me this, but actually was well grounded intellectually, that there are objective foundations for the Christian faith. And so, yes, in pursuit of answers, it was actually the Christian faith that resolved the issues. Does it mean that there are no questions or that I've resolved everything? Certainly not. But in terms of putting the pieces of the puzzle together in the best way that I know how to, I find the Christian faith does answer the big questions where other worldviews fall short.
We'll come to your reasons for actually writing the book in just a moment. But also joining me, as I said on the program today, Norman Backrack, who's been with us a few times before. Thank you, Norman, for coming back today. Norman, yourself, have you had any sort of religious upbringing or anything like that? Did you drop that or always felt comfortable with the atheist humanist title?
Both my parents were, I would call, secular, and my mother in particular was always quite rational, I would say, so I never had any religious beliefs to get rid of, and I've always been, as far as I can tell, from the earliest ages, pretty well sceptical and atheist.
You obviously feel strongly enough about that to, as it were, put your beliefs out there, or non-beliefs, you might say, depending on the way you you quantify them. What is it that sort of makes you want to be, as it were, you know, to make the case for atheism, to say, I really don't... I mean, do you see religion as harmful? Do you see that there is a sort of something to be counteracted?
Yeah, I see the whole religious outlook as a monstrous, to use the word in Paul's own book, relic, if you like, of past ways of looking at things, and that's something we don't need to use anymore. We obviously still have to work out how to live and morals. That may be something we come to later on in this discussion. But I don't see the notion of a creator God who created pain and pleasure, heaven and hell, judgment, all the particular theological bits seem to me to be something we can usefully get rid of. And insofar as they're still around, they just hold back useful discussion of how to live.
Paul, coming to you, before we get into the subject of the book, do you kind of have much opportunity to engage with those who hold Norman's perspective? And what would be your answer to this person who says, I think these are relics of the past and they can be usefully jettisoned now?
Well, one of the, you know, I mean, I certainly do engage in this sort of a discussion on a regular basis. In various open forums and public discussions, I'm routinely engaging with people who think along the lines of Norman. And in fact, I even had a brief interchange with Richard Dawkins himself when he came into town and asked him about his own deterministic views. But one of the things that I would say in response is that it's actually the Christian faith, that, you know, the more broadly speaking, the Judeo-Christian faith that has actually shaped Western civilization. And one of the things that I argue in my book, I quote Max Stackhouse from Princeton University, who argues that in the that historians who are being intellectually honest have to acknowledge that it has been the Jewish Christian faith that has informed the human rights movement in the West, that it was not due to a secular movement, but is thoroughly rooted in the biblical tradition. In fact, one of the leading intellectuals in Europe, Jürgen Habermas, a German philosopher, has said that the Judaic ethic of justice and the Christian ethic of love has basically shaped our understanding of rights and dignity and worth and our legal system. And he said that this is really what informs the way that we think about rights, about morality. And he said that anything else is just postmodern talk or just kind of idle chatter, because to try to pin it on anything else would just be intellectually dishonest. So, you know, and there's a book that Alvin Schmidt wrote documenting the influence of the Christian faith. It's how Christianity influenced Western civilization. And he goes through from the very beginning, from the first century onward, to talk about the remarkable moral gains that were made through the impetus of Christians who are living out their faith consistently. It doesn't mean that people have not, professing Christians have not, have been thoroughly consistent throughout the ages, certainly not, but the general outflow of the biblical worldview has actually shaped the West and made many of the gains in terms of democracy, human rights, and so forth that many humanists and atheists like Norman applaud.
I'm sure Norman would like to respond to that, but I feel we must turn to the actual subject in hand, which is the question: is God a moral monster? What drove you to write this book exactly, Paul? You obviously write books on all kinds of subjects. Why this one in particular?
Well, one of the things that motivated me to write this is that there is very little written on it, and especially in an accessible manner. And when the New Atheists started to write about the, quote, Old Testament God. In fact, I use Richard Dawkins' phrase, God is a moral monster, I'm using his work. In fact, the New Atheist, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and Daniel Dennett, I use quotations from them that are actually my chapter headings in the book. So I wanted to take the bull by the horns and address the issues that they were raising, and make it accessible to people who, what I wanted to show is that as we look at the Old Testament text more closely, we find that a lot of the passages that are being referred to as being, God is being seen as a moral monster, actually, when you look more closely, you find that there are ways of understanding this that are actually, not only fair to the text, but actually seen in their proper light, highlight the morally elevated status of what the Old Testament is talking about in contrast to the rest of the ancient Near East. So we see moral advance rather than moral backwardness in the ancient Near East.
You've read the book.
Wanted to write to address the issues that were being highlighted by the New Atheists and say a lot of the things that they're saying are distortions of the actual picture.
I don't know if he'd class himself a New Atheist because he's been around a while, Norman. But Norman, what did you make of the book? You read it.
I did read Paul's book and found it very interesting. And the interesting thing is that what Paul Copan has done has really given a kind of commentary. But that is exactly the tradition, which in fact is 2,000 years old, commentaries on the Bible. You can even look at the later prophets in the Old Testament, how they, in a sense, sometimes contradicted earlier statements. And then Talmud, Mishnah, the people, the rabbis living at the same time as Jesus, they all made commentary on it. And you've done your commentary. So, and then in Islam, you've got the traditions there. So what it seems to me to mean is that you need human beings to comment on all these allegedly divine instructions and commands and soften them down and reinterpret them. This is a sort of a perfectly valid humanistic thing. But I just must say, I think there are other traditions in Western civilization, the classical traditions, Socrates, plenty of other people like that, who all contributed to Western civilization.
We are going to, I think, drill down now into some of the actual issues that Paul addresses, and the key one, as I said earlier, that I'd like to address is the stories that you find in places like Deuteronomy, the Chronicles, Joshua, of the slaughter of whole towns of people, including, as is sometimes specified, women and children. And what do we make of the fact that God is alleged, God is the one who, if you like, kicks that whole thing off, orders the Israelite people to carry out these slaughter. We know what sort of areas we're addressing here in the Old Testament. Maybe start with you, Norman. What do you make of these stories? How do you sort of take them? Do they, for you, bear out Richard Dawkins' statement? And I suppose the most the one that sticks out here in regard to this is the bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser that Dawkins describes God as. Is that sort of what these passages say to you if we were to take them at face value?
I'm not sure about bloodthirsty, but certainly ethnic cleanser. If I can quote from Paul's own words in his book, he says, "Sometimes God simply gives up on nations, cities, and individuals when they've gone past a point of no return." In other words, they need judgment, which in practice means death for them. So what you're saying, Paul, is you justify some of these ethnic cleansing type episodes in the about 500 or 600 or 700 BC as being necessary. First of all, God gave up on those people altogether, which seems pretty monstrous. But then they were actually necessary, in your opinion, to prepare the way for later, for Jesus is coming later, and so on. So the end justifies the means. So this seems a pretty ruthless, it may be the way you see it, but it seems a pretty ruthless way of justifying what to, on the face of it, seems unjustified killing of innocent people.
Well, were these people innocent, as far as you're concerned, Paul?
Well, a couple of things. If I may say, you know, if we talk about 500 or 600 or 700 BC, we are talking about divine judgment. But in those centuries, it was actually God's judgment on the people of Israel, the northern and southern kingdoms, in 700 BC, 722 and 586 BC, the northern and southern kingdoms respectively. God was, you know, had given up on Israel and Judah. Precisely for that reason. But did that mean that he slaughtered them all? No. In fact, the very language that is used of the destruction of the, quote, destruction of the Canaanites is the same language that is applied to the northern and southern kingdoms of Israel. But they certainly were not wiped out, but they were certainly politically disabled. Their centers of power were gutted. And what I argue in the book is that the sort of activity that was taking place in the land of Canaan, these were disabling raids, rather than wholesale slaughter. And so there were, sexual promiscuity, you had infant sacrifice, and other, grotesque practices, and God brought judgment upon them, but the primary centers that were being focused on were cities which were not population centers, but were rather places where the military, political, and religious leadership were stationed. And even so, it was not as though these were wholesale, there was wholesale destruction. And I guess my question would be, if Norman believes that these were literally carried out by the Israelites, then why don't we have the archaeological confirmation to support that? We've got a kind of a, one or the other. I guess I'd put it to Norm. Do you maintain that this literally happened or not?
Okay, well, you're right, of course. The Canaanite thing was probably much earlier than the 500 or 600. It may have been 500 or 600 years before that. You may well be right that there wasn't in practice total genocide. You may be right in your description that this was simply one population moving into an area of another, and it was more of a military confrontation. This may well be right, but I think in this particular, what we're now dealing with is not so much judging the actions of humans, but the actions of God in apparently justifying all this, including the killing of innocent people and wiping out of cities and nations, as part of his master plan. And the question is, if there is such a creator God, and is it really moral for him to instruct people to act in this way? This, I think, is the issue at the moment.
So say people who say sacrifice their children on hot molten altars, that you would consider those people innocent?
Not at all, but it appears to be pretty indiscriminate as we see it. This, I think, is one of the problems. And you say also that the Creator God has the right to take the life of children, simply because he's the Creator, life of children, that is, not the children who were killed inadvertently, if you like, in these military actions. And then you say they would go to heaven anyway. So these are your justifications for when children are killed by the battles that had to take place.
Let's give some context to this. Let me just read briefly from, for instance, Joshua, the story. It's a Sunday school story, isn't it? Joshua marching around with his troops, the city of Jericho, and the walls fall down. Now, what isn't so often focused upon in the Sunday school class is what you would find in Joshua chapter 6, verses, 21. Which follows, then they devoted to destruction by the edge of the sword all in the city, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep and donkeys. I mean, it is a picture of sort of wiping out everyone, children included. And I think for a lot of people, while they could see the argument that people doing things wrong perhaps deserve judgment in the eyes of God, Paul, how could that possibly apply to children, to babies, to, how do we get around this particular issue?
Yeah, well, I think, again, putting this issue in even broader context, I would argue that that is kind of a fallback position. What I argue, my primary argument, is that the texts of Joshua, Deuteronomy, are hyperbolized texts which were kind of standard fare in the ancient Near East. You could have someone win by a narrow margin. In fact, one Moabite king had an inscription that said, Israel is no more. Now we know, actually Moab is no more, not Israel is no more. There were, but that was the level of exaggeration that was standard in ancient Near Eastern war texts. And Israel, the war texts of Israel are no exception. Let me give you an example. In Joshua 11:22, it says, there were no Anakim left in the land. Well, then, and it says in chapter 11 also that they were utterly destroyed in the hill country. But yet, three chapters later, Caleb asked permission to drive out the Anakites from the hill country. And so what you have is, yes, the language of, wiping out, leaving alive nothing that breathes, but then you have the language of lots of survivors being left. And the main thrust is that the language is of driving out the Canaanites, driving them out. Displacement is the language rather than slaughter. In fact, when Adam and Eve are driven out of the garden, it is not that they are killed when they are driven out of the garden. The language is far more numerous of the references to dispossessing or driving out are far more numerous than slaughter or destruction or something like that. And I guess I would just encourage the critics to be fair to that kind of language. If you use the language of driving out, then we're not talking about utterly destroying. Secondly, what we are also noting is that God is primarily concerned about disabling the moral and religious structures of the Canaanites. For example, in Deuteronomy chapter 7, it uses the language of wiping them out, of destroying and so forth, but then it says, do not intermarry with them in the next verse, do not make covenants with them and so forth, so that you won't fall into the practices of these Canaanites. That was the primary motivation. God is concerned not so much about wiping out Canaanites as he is about disabling the moral and religious structures of the Canaanite people so that there would be a moral and theological preparation for the coming of the Messiah. So it's not quite how Norman has construed it. And so I want to put the emphasis where it ought to be placed. Remember, even Rahab, who was a Canaanite, was able to participate in the people of Israel. She joined, she joined up with them. She even was the forebear, the ancestor of Jesus the Messiah. So it was not directed toward an ethnic people. In fact, God himself, throughout the Old Testament, in the Psalms and Zechariah, he emphasizes his concern for the salvation of the Canaanites, like the Jebusites. So there is an ethnic concern that God, from the very beginning, is concerned to bring blessing to all the nations,
and including
the Canaanites.
And you elaborate in the book exactly just how bad the Canaanite practices were and why God would be offended by them and want to see them eliminated, as you say. I mean, but Maureen, what do you make of this argument that Paul has in the book that we need to understand that there was an element of hyperbole in some of the accounts and the way it's described, and you can see that in fact it wasn't as final and decimative as is sometimes made out when you just read a bit further on in the same book. Does that for you help to give some understanding to these passages?
There may well have been exaggeration in if you treat them as descriptions of what happened. People probably weren't totally wiped out, but there's still, if we're still debating the morality of God, if you like, there are still plenty of examples. The punishment of Adam and Eve meant that the future human race apparently had an original sin implanted in them. Then you've got the flood as another example, where the whole of humanity was apparently wiped out. There are plenty of examples which might be the basis for what Dawkins is talking about in that sentence that was quoted earlier. So you've got to take in view the whole picture, it seems to me, of the way God is presented in the Bible.
We will come back to Paul with maybe some reflections on what's just been said there by Norman. But if you'd like to, as I said earlier, join in and give your reflections, particularly on these passages about the Canaanites and killing in the name of Yahweh, etc., be interested to hear from you. Unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget you can phone in and leave me a voicemail message as well. That's 08456 52 52 52 and select the option for leaving a message for Unbelievable. We're going to go to a quick break. break now. We'll be back in a moment with Paul Copan again. He's the author of Is God a Moral Monster, published by Baker Books, available in all good Christian bookstores, and of course links to it with the podcast of this programme, which you can find at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We'll be back in just a moment's time. As I said earlier, Richard Dawkins has a famous phrase that he puts out at the beginning of The God Delusion, describing God as a petty, unjust, unforgiving, control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty, ethnic cleanser, and much more besides. It's one of the key claims of atheists these days that if you're looking for morality, don't go to the Bible, because you won't find it there, especially when you look at the Acts of the Old Testament. Well, Paul Copan has written a book specifically, if you like, responding to those claims. Is God a Moral Monster? Paul is a chair of philosophy and ethics at Palm Beach Atlantic University in Florida. He's on the line, and with me in the studio today is Norman Bachrach, who's an atheist humanist and has read the book and is responding with why he believes God is a moral monster if you take these Bible verses at face value. We've been talking about some of the acts of warfare and killing, and well, you were saying how, Paul, we don't necessarily have to understand these as literally complete devastation and wiping out of all people, because it's obvious from the text themselves that that isn't actually what occurred. I'd like to come back to that. Before we do, obviously, what Norman brought up there just at the end was, well, if you look at the whole picture of the Bible, Adam and Eve sinning and bringing a curse on the whole of humanity, the flood, you know, you have to look at the bigger picture to see that the God that's being described is not a very pleasant character. Have you got any sort of general comments on that big picture issue?
Sure, a few things. One is that we need to remember that in many places, we may be culturally blinded to certain moral standards, or we may be blinded to certain have blunted moral intuitions because of our own culture, that our moral judgments are not always reliable. I'm not saying that that means that we overturn everything. But let me give you an example, and I cite this in the book, and I think it's very illustrative of what may be going on here. And I quote the Yale theologian Miroslav Volf, who was born in Croatia, who lived through the nightmare years of ethnic strife in the former Yugoslavia, including the destruction of churches, the rape of women, the murder of innocents. And, you know, in his view, early on, he thought that wrath and anger were beneath the dignity of a good God. But he came to realize that his view of God had been too low, rather than too high. And he says this about his experience. He says, "I used to think that wrath was unworthy of God. Isn't God love? Shouldn't divine love be beyond wrath? God is love, and God loves every person and every creature. That's exactly why God is wrathful against some of them. My last resistance to the idea of God's wrath was a casualty of the war in the former Yugoslavia, the region from which I come. According to some estimates, 200,000 people were killed and over 3 million were displaced. My villages and cities were destroyed. My people shelled day in and day out, some of them brutalized beyond imagination. And I could not imagine God not being angry. Or think of Rwanda in the last decade of the past century, where 800,000 people were hacked to death in 100 days. How did God react to the carnage? By doting on the perpetrators in a grandfatherly fashion? By refusing to condemn the bloodbath, but instead affirming the perpetrators' basic goodness? Wasn't God fiercely angry with them? Though I used to complain about the indecency of the idea of God's wrath, I came to think that I would have to rebel against a God who wasn't wrathful at the sight of the world's evil. God isn't wrathful in spite of being love. God is wrathful because God is love." And so I think that this is an apt summary of the very heart of what is going on in many of these passages that are often cited in the Old Testament, that God is mean and nasty and so forth. Well, maybe this is partly because of our blunted moral sensibilities that we are, you know, when it comes to maybe sexual morality, there are some we have been, I think, jaded or blunted by the kind of sexual freedom, the sexual promiscuity that we see throughout our Western culture, and this perhaps has caused our conscience to be seared, to be blunted, and we are not seeing things as clearly as we should from a moral point of view.
So there you go, Norman. Love doesn't exclude anger. It's righteous anger, if you like, at the things that people do which are wrong. Is not, God is rightfully angry about those things, wrathful towards those things.
Anyone who reads the daily papers is going to get angry at some of the things that happen when someone is still in today's world being stoned for adultery, for example, in certain parts of the world. Yugoslavia, while it was an atheist regime, the Eastern Orthodox parts of it in Serbia and the Roman Catholics in Croatia and the Muslims in Bosnia apparently lived together relatively in peace. Once the dictatorship ended and it broke up into separate religious factions, then all hell broke loose. But my real complaint about this, if we're judging God himself in this matter, is the whole notion of that you should do good because you'll be rewarded in some way for heaven. If you do something bad, you'll go to hell. This whole notion of judgment seems to be pretty well obsolete. A final point, there are plenty of statements in the Bible, e.g. homosexuality is an abomination. Well, many people in Africa believe this, for example. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. Many people in Africa and India believe this. And what I'm saying is there are plenty of statements in the Bible which I don't think we can now support.
And one of the things that I do note in the book is that I'm not advocating this sort of a thing for in terms of a universal moral code for all people. This is a theocracy, and there are special responsibilities and duties, indeed promises that Israel made to God to be faithful to him alone. So there was an agreement made between the people of God and God himself to maintain a moral and theological purity. So I think we have to be careful about extending this to say, therefore, if this is God's word, it has to apply to all people at all times. That is, that is counter to what I'm saying in the book.
I think this is something that often comes up, and to break in there, Paul, is that very often verses are thrown at the Christian by an atheist and saying, well, the Bible says do this and do that, so why aren't you doing this and doing that? And what you're saying is actually, we don't have to take everything that's written in the Old Testament as immediately applicable in our situation today.
That is correct. It was a temporary arrangement, a theocracy, if you will, that is not something that is the expectation. It is not carried over into the New Testament. It is not the people of God are not a national ethnic group. Rather, they are scattered throughout in different parts of the world under different governments, but united in Christ. And so, therefore, the various civic laws, legal codes, and so forth in the Old Testament do not automatically carry over to them. In fact, there is a reason for curtailing those in light of the new the advent of the new people of God, the new Israel, namely the Church.
Mm. So but you're right to. I did interrupt you, though. So just carry on with what you were.
Just one point on that. What about statements in the New Testament about people being consigned to outer darkness, where men will weep, and the fires of hell? These statements are part of the New Testament too. The notion of heaven and hell and judgment is an intrinsic part of Christianity, at least it has been for a couple of thousand years. I don't know whether you maintain that or you think that too needs to be humanized.
Well, what I would say, if we take the images in the scriptures literally, then they would cancel each other out. For example, you've got fire and you've got darkness. If we take those literally, they would cancel each other out. I think the essence of hell is really to be away from the presence of God, as 2 Thessalonians 1 says, to be away from the presence of God. That is, if you don't want God, you get no God. People who want God will get God. And this is so to be so. I'm not taking a literalistic view of the language of hell, but hell is self-exclusion. As C.S. Lewis said, the door of hell is closed from the inside. He said there are two kinds of people: those who say to God, "Thy will be done," and those to whom God says, "Thy will be done." And, you know, kind of to quote Milton's Paradise Lost, where Satan says, better to rule in hell than serve in heaven. So this is really what I see as the essence of the issue. And it makes sense that if we want no God, we ultimately get our divorce from God in the afterlife.
Before I don't want to turn this into an issue, you know, because there's a very interesting discussion on heaven and hell coming up in 2 weeks' time. With Rob Bell is going to be in the studio with me in conversation with Adrian Warnock on that. But besides that, I interrupted you, Paul, and my apologies because you were going on to make another point. And if you've forgotten it by now, that's quite all right. But what were you going to say?
I suppose I would add, as we, you know, even if you know, you said you were going to go back to the to the question of the
hyperbole,
the Old Testament, and the Canaanites, and I thought I would mention just this, and I think also a partial response to what Norman has been raising. By the way, Norman, thank you very much for your very good, cordial, engaging conversation. I would say that as we look at what takes place in the ancient Near East around the time that the Israelites come into the land of Canaan, from an archaeological point of view, we see actually what is borne out in the biblical text itself, that there is not a sudden military onslaught where all the Canaanites are wiped out, but rather we see a, you know, yes, some military action, but it is a gradual infiltration, a gradual move into the land, and that archaeologically, that is precisely what we see. That it really takes over two centuries before there is a displacement. And this is, I think, the sort of thing that is being talked about, a driving out or a displacement or even in some ways a kind of assimilation of Canaanite peoples, but a repudiation, you know, a desired repudiation of their theology and moral practices.
Going back to what you said about that whole tying into the idea that there was, in some sense, passages used hyperbole when it talked about, you know, the instant, you know, massacre and a complete destruction of the Canaanite people. I mean, Dave Parker emailed me in advance of today's show and wanted to ask on this subject. He's seen other apologists making this point. The blog of Matt and Madeline Flanagan, I think it is, in New Zealand, has been posting articles of a similar point. But he said that he heard on a recent edition of Stand to Reason podcast, Clay Jones was interviewed, and he argued that regardless of any hyperbole, God did intend for every Canaanite to be wiped out, and the lack of that actually happening was actually a fault of the Israelites. Now, that obviously contrasts somewhat with your view, Paul. What's your response to that particular
Well, it's
view?
Interesting. I'd say a couple of things. One is that when we read routinely in the book of Joshua that Joshua carried out all that Moses commanded. Well, if he did that, then why are all those survivors left? There are plenty of survivors mentioned in Joshua. It's, you know, the book of Joshua itself. In fact, at the end, Joshua refers to the nations that remain among you. So there are you know, lots of Canaanites still there. So if Joshua is literally carrying out all that Moses commanded, and we take that command literally, then that was a failure. So I know Clay Jones, but I would disagree with him on that point. And I would say that as you read the text, God is, you know, the primary upshot, you know, is that God is seeking to drive out the Canaanites. That is the language, to disable their moral and spiritual centers and structures, that these are more disabling raids, as the archaeologist Kenneth Kitchen says. So there is a gradual assimilation of the people into the land, and this is reflected in the archaeological record. So it seems that we are looking at, again, if we're taking the language of Moses to leave nothing alive, nothing that breathes, but yet there are a lot of people left alive that breathes, well, then Moses himself in Deuteronomy 20 must have intended there to be, just a disabling, a gutting of the people of Canaan in terms of their religious and even political power. But that doesn't, that says nothing about the, you know, the Canaanites that remain. And again, the issue of disobedience was, God commanded the Israel to drive out out the Canaanites. That we see that in early on in Exodus 23, that this was what God was primarily concerned about, a driving out rather than utter annihilation. Mm. If you're driving out, you're not going to be killing the people you're driving out, because they're going to be dead. So I'd say the language itself bespeaks something beyond or different from what Clay Jones is saying.
Norman.
Okay, well, today we call driving out ethnic cleansing. But just another incident, I'd like
to... No, I don't think we do. I think we call ethnic cleansing the sort of thing that we see in Rwanda, genocide. That is the sort of thing that we are talking about. We're not saying that at all. And what I said earlier is the same language is being applied to Israel when God says, just as I judge the Canaanites, I'm going to judge you. And does he do it? Yes, through exile. But certainly the people of Israel are not utterly destroyed.
Just Saul was ordered to kill at one point all the sheep and goats and other things in a town they were attacking. But Saul kept the best sheep and goats and didn't sacrifice them. And wasn't God angry at that?
Sure, and I think the primary anger was, of course, when he leaves aside the king himself, King Agag. And you've raised a good point, 1 Samuel 15. You get the impression from that very passage, again, another war text using the same language of Deuteronomy and Joshua, and you get the impression that all the Amalekites are completely wiped out. You'd think, oh, there's just one remaining Amalekite, and the prophet Samuel comes and finishes him off, right? Well, no, wrong. What we do is we see that there is an entire army of Amalekites at the end of 1 Samuel, and David is fighting against them. In fact, there are 400 of them who end up escaping. So even within 1 Samuel itself, we see the language that that seems to be so literal and sweeping and so forth is actually just the same kind of rhetorical language that is being used, the hyperbolic language that is being used standardly in the ancient Near East, and we see that actually borne out by the contrast in 1 Samuel 30, where there is an entire army.
When do we decide that God Himself is speaking hyperbolically, and when He's speaking literally? How do we make that decision?
Well, I think we look at the genres, we look at the types of literature that we are examining, and so we treat poetic texts with poetically. We look at historical narrative, but when we realize that there are war texts in the ancient Near East that regularly resort to hyperbole and exaggeration, that you can have someone who wins just by a narrow margin, but says he utterly wiped them out, then we need to maybe do a double take and say, okay, maybe we haven't been reading this text.
As we should in its
context.
Is it the case, Paul, that some Christians may worry you're solving one problem only to replace it with another, which is the idea that then the truth isn't being told here? Hyperbole means an exaggeration. A story is told where a whole city is apparently ransacked, but then you say, no, that wasn't actually what happened. Is there a problem for the person who says, well, does that make the story God a liar rather than a moral monster?
We need someone like you, Paul, to interpret it properly for us.
Actually, no. All you need to do is look more closely at the biblical text, and what you see are, on the one hand, sweeping language of utter destruction, and then, on the other hand, lots of survivors. And when you see the language of the destruction being applied to the Israelites themselves as they are brought into exile, we realize, something similar is going on here. It's not an utter annihilation. So God threatens that he's going to judge the Israelites just as he has judged the Canaanites. But we see a lot of Israelites left around, in fact, coming back to the land after the Babylonian exile. So I think we just have to be careful about how we read these texts. But I'm saying that within the biblical text itself, we have the resources for grappling with these issues rather than taking one side, namely the obliteration texts, and ignoring the driving out text or the survivor text.
Can I just ask you, sorry to interrupt, do you really believe that God does actually intervene in history, either by physically doing things like the flood, or by giving inspiration to particular people? And has he stopped intervening now?
Well, I'd say I think that we're not in the privileged position of having special revelation, and so I am troubled when people say, "Oh, this or that happened because of God's judgment on this or that people." Like when Katrina came through New Orleans and said, "Oh, God is judging New Orleans because of its decadence." Well, ironically, the French Quarter, which is allegedly the most decadent part of New Orleans, was left untouched by Katrina, and all these outlying areas are left utterly devastated, including. Friends of mine who are at New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, 10 feet, 12 feet underwater. I think we have to be very cautious about rendering those judgments. But I would take cues from Jesus in the passage in Luke chapter 13, where he is asked, why did this tower fall? He's asked, why did Pilate have these Galileans killed? And Jesus himself raises this natural evil of a tower falling on people. And he says, do you think that these were worse sinners than the rest? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you will likewise perish. Here we have Jesus basically saying, don't try to figure out the reason for why this is happening, but make sure that you are in right standing with God. And I think that that is the general call from the problem of evil to all of us, that we make sure that we look where we stand in relationship to God, that we recognize that we need outside assistance. As C.S. Lewis said, pain is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world.
We're going to start to wrap things up here, gentlemen. I mean, I didn't want to let this go without at some level kind of looking at the actual issue of morality, because from the outset, what you said at the top of the program, Norman, is that as an atheist humanist, you don't feel we need God to kind of be an arbiter of what is moral. You see the Old Testament, the Bible as a whole, as simply human people's attempt to grapple with morality, and we see in some sense an evolution, you would say, of morality in that, but that's only a testament to the fact that it is a man-made thing. Do you feel then that that morality is, as it were, a purely human construct in some sense?
Yes, Paul just quoted C.S. Lewis as saying that we need the notion of God. I think he used the term megaphone. I'm sure this is sociologically what happened in the past, that people invented the idea of a God and judgment and heaven and hell in order to make people moral. That was its social function. But the question really is, for us living today, is that any use now? Is it not now an impediment that the people you don't do good because of a future reward in heaven, or bad things because you're scared of hell? That whole way of looking at things is now obsolete, and you now have to judge, do good because you think it might cause someone happiness or pleasure, and you don't do something harmful because you don't want to cause pain. That these are perfectly good standalone reasons for human action, and therefore the whole notion of a theology and judgment is now obsolete.
What do you say to that, Paul?
Well, I'd say on the question of reward and punishment, I would say on the one hand, reward is simply coincidental. It is not the reason we do something, but it is something that comes as a result. That is not the goal that one is seeking. The goal is, what is eternal life? To know God and Jesus Christ whom he has sent. This is the ultimate reward, a relationship with the true and living God. So any sort of reward that comes with that, heaven, etc., that's in a sense, that's just extra. Those are just extra benefits. That's not the reason that we enter into relationship with God. The relationship with God is the end in itself. Secondly, I do find it problematic from a naturalistic or atheist point of view to ground anything like human dignity and worth if we are simply the products of material, deterministic forces, unguided by anything outside of themselves, totally without any value in and of themselves, suddenly or somehow producing value, dignity and worth and rights. I'm saying if you get rid of God, you don't have the grounding for dignity and worth. The theist offers a move from value, namely God as the supreme good and intrinsically valuable being. He makes all human beings in his image, including atheists, so they can recognize the same sorts of moral truths that theists can. But God, who makes us in his image, gives, you know, endows human beings with value and dignity and worth.
I mean,
so
essentially,
we move in theism from value to value, unlike naturalism, which moves from valueless processes to somehow producing valuable rights-bearing beings. I'd say, the theist offers a grounding for affirming human dignity, human worth, human rights, and this is what the historical record shows.
And you're not saying here that the atheist can't be moral. On the contrary, atheists recognize morality as much as the next person, but they can't ground the reason for morality in anything on an atheistic worldview where there is no ultimate moral standard, if you like, by which we are to live. Or, you know, it boils down essentially to one opinion over another, presumably. But what's your response, Norman? I don't want to...
The response would be that we can't assume that God is good unless we ourselves have an understanding of good and value. So ultimately, you can't just take it that because a being created the universe, he must be benevolent. If you decide he is benevolent, it's because you've already got your values there. So this was a problem invented by Socrates and discussed in his books and so on. You don't obey a god simply because he's a powerful creator. You have to do it because it's in what he's saying is intrinsically good. So I say you cannot ground morality just by saying there is a god, therefore morality. It can't work that way. Ultimately, it comes on your human decision about what is right and good.
We're going to get a response from you, Paul, in a moment, because we're just running out of time on this section of the programme. So tune in again in 2 minutes, 3 minutes' time to see how Paul responds to that. It sounds something like Euthyphro's dilemma, I think, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Euthyphro, I think. We'll see what Paul has to say in response to that. We're kind of getting to the nub of the actual what underlies the whole concept of morality at this point in the programme. And fascinating discussion we've had today on the God of the Old Testament and whether, you know, the acts that happen in the Old Testament, are described in the Old Testament, have any bearing upon the moral character of God? Is God a moral monster? Is the question we've been asking today. If you want to get hold of the book by Paul Copan, I'm going to post a link with the podcast to this program, but it's called Is God a Moral Monster? Published by Baker Books. You should find it in most good Christian bookstores and online, of course. So do search online and check out the Unbelievable webpage for more details. premier.org.uk/Unbelievable. We'll be back in just a moment's time with some final concluding thoughts from both our guests. As I say, Paul Copan is a Christian guest on the program today, author of Is God a Moral Monster? Making Sense of the Old Testament God. And Paul is in conversation today with Norman Backrack, who's with me in the studio. Paul lives out in Florida, lucky fellow, and he is a pledger chair of philosophy and ethics at Palm Beach Atlantic University. So he has a marvellous view of the crystal blue sea over there. But Paul, we got sort of had to cut off early from you, and I just wondered what your response would be to Norman, who essentially posed Euthyphro's dilemma to you, that which, as I understand it, runs something like this. Okay, you claim that God is the only, you know, moral, the only thing that makes sense of ultimate moral values, but don't we do things because they're good rather than God says they're good? And that it's not, you know, if God said that rape was good, that wouldn't make it good. So the good is independent of God, and so you haven't solved the problem by positing God. Any answer to that?
Sure. A fuller answer, I've written at my, you can track this down on my website, paulcopan.com, an article that I've written called Naturalism, Theism, and the Foundations of Morality, which I go into a lot of detail on the Euthyphro dilemma, which isn't a dilemma at all. What you do is, to avoid the horns of the dilemma, you say that God is in his character, is the source of objective moral values, that it is not arbitrary. God acts, and he simply does what is good. But as I found it was interesting that Norman said that that morality is rooted in human decision. Well, that's precisely the problem that he's charging the Euthyphro by raising the Euthyphro dilemma, saying, oh, God said it, therefore it's right or wrong. But what about humans? Do humans declare something to be right, and therefore that makes it objectively right? What about the conflict of morality throughout the world? Michael Ruse said that morality is a corporate illusion fobbed off on us by our genes to get us to cooperate, and that morality could have gone a number of different directions. So it's not even up to human decision, but rather up to human genetics. But I would say the primary problem is it's not as though we're just positing God and saying, oh, therefore God must be the source of value. We're saying, how does naturalism ground human rights and human dignity and human worth? And what I'm saying is that naturalism does not have the resources, so there must be some other source for grounding human dignity and worth and rights and so forth that transcend culture, that transcends biology. And so I would argue that it is something, that goodness must be rooted in something outside of the natural world rather than within it, that we move from something valuable out there to value within the universe, that this is the metaphysical grounding that we need to be looking for. So it's not as though we're just saying, oh, God must be the answer. I'm saying naturalism itself does not have the resources for moving from valueless processes to value and dignity and worth. Theism is much better equipped to do that.
We'll have one last response from you, Norman, and we'll make this, if you like, your concluding statement as well, if you would, because we're running out of time.
Okay. The problem is, I don't think the problem is as great as you say it is, Paul. You just consider what Jeremy Bentham said. He said, what ultimately matters when you're discussing matters of morality is pleasure and pain. What are the consequences of your action? Now, the problem for you is that your God created pain in the first place, because he created it before there was a universe. There was no pain and no suffering. So that enormous monstrosity is, you've really got to explain that. But from the naturalist point of view, from the atheist point of view, evolution turned up. We've got these experiences of pleasure and pain. The pain is unfortunate, and we try to get rid of it and minimize it as far as possible. It's a natural product. Now, we're not the product of our genes. We've got culture, and it's our culture which gives us our values, and that's how we can work out the right way to behave. And that is why, that is the foundation, really. So, if you like, evolution has given us the capacity to invent moral systems, just like the advanced social animals have their do's and don'ts. But we, therefore, can refine that and discuss it and decide on our particular moral system, what is right and wrong, and so on and so forth. And we don't need to rely on what people 3,000 years ago said, because we have to evaluate it now. While we are alive, this is our chance to do that.
Thank you for joining us on the programme today, Norman, and thank you for your contributions as we've looked at these Old Testament passages. Any final response from you, Paul, as we draw things to a close?
Sure. I would say that it sounds like Norman believes in, say, free will and rationality and so forth, that this is somehow grounded in, that evolution gives the capacity for these things. I'd say, no, it is these deterministic processes that actually thwart the possibility of free will and of rationality. If we are rational, it is, if we happen to be right about this, it is totally by accident, because our beliefs have been pumped into us by forces beyond our control. I think Norman is helping himself to a theistic framework that grounds rationality, that grounds free will, that grounds value. I don't see how determinism, with its valueless processes, non-rational processes, material deterministic processes, could somehow land us in human beings that have free will over their actions, that have rationality over their thoughts, in their thinking processes. I just don't see how that is grounded, given the resources that naturalism provides.
Well, in just one second, I can't deal with all that, except that when you say we make free decisions if we can do what we wish, but determinism means that what we wish depends on our whole past history. That is true. That is determinism. But it also means why we must have, if you're an atheist humanist, you must have compassion automatically for every human and everything, because you realize that whatever it was the necessary outcome of prior history. And that is the great advantage of the atheist humanist position. You can understand all human action in principle as the result of causes in the past. And that gives you the opportunity to improve and change the future.
suggest, though, that
but
there
I
is...
That those are determined by processes over which you have no control.
No,
that
not
is
at all.
Pumped into you by material processes over which you have no control.
Yeah,
so there is no ultimate rationality. It's just a coincidence to be correct about this.
A computer has got hardware and software. The hardware means it will always obey the laws of physics. But whether it gives you your correct figure for your income tax depends on whether you put in the right software. We control the software that goes into our brains as computers. Certainly they work by the laws of physics. But we have the opportunity.
We have control over our brains.
We human beings, in our discussion, like our present discussion, we are now changing the, if you like, the software in the brains of all the listeners. That is our opportunity.
Well, it sounds like individual cells there, rather than just brains pumping information into us.
It's interesting. Thank you, guys. We've obviously delved into some length a different topic that has come out of this, but thank you very much for your interactions. And there are many programs besides where we've discussed the moral argument for God, which is essentially what Paul has been presenting us with, and I'll put one or two of those up alongside today's broadcast as well, so you can look at some of those at your leisure as and when you have time. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Well, if you want to get hold of a copy of Paul's book, Is God a Moral Monster? I'd recommend it to you. It's available in Christian bookstores, and I'm going to put a link with it alongside the podcast of this program as well. Thanks, Paul, for being with me today. I look forward to perhaps having you on again in the future at some point. For the moment, enjoy the sun out there in Florida. And take our greetings with you back to you and yours.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
And thanks also, Norman, for being good sport coming in today.
Thank you.
To engage on this subject.
Thanks for listening to today's Classic Replay edition of Unbelievable. Do get in touch with your thoughts over at our show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, where you'll find out about some of the exciting resources we're currently launching this autumn. Do make sure to check it out. There's loads of great stuff happening on Unbelievable. For now, though, thanks for being with us for today's Classic Replay, and see you next time.